All right, our next presenter is Andrew Chumney. Andrew is a partner with Peacock Keller since 2011 and focuses his practice on representation of coal, oil, and natural gas producers and other energy-related businesses. After joining Peacock Keller in 2003, Andrew rotated among various sections within the firm, gaining experience on all facets of law ranging from litigation to employment law and estates and trusts. He now utilizes that experience by representing some of the county's largest energy producers in a broad array of energy and real estate related matters, including mineral title issues, land and mineral acquisitions, leasing, lease negotiations, asset sales and transactions, permitting and regulatory issues associated with coal bed methane and natural gas wells. Andrew graduated from Washington and Jefferson College, cum laude, in 2000 with a Bachelor of Arts degree in history. In 2003, Andrew received his JD degree from Duquesne University Law School, serving as the Executive Articles Editor for the Duquesne Law Review. Mr. Chumney is a member of the Washington County and Pennsylvania Bar Associations and the Energy and Mineral Law Foundation, and regularly presents on energy-related topics to various organizations. Please join me in welcoming Mr. Andrew Chumney.
Thanks, Jim. I can guarantee that my presentation is not going to be as exciting or as important as what was just talked about earlier, because safety and production are way up there compared to this. So, but what I am going to talk about is what I think is probably the most important legal issue as it pertains to land surface use when it comes to coal mining and the relationship between gas operators today. And that's how you operate the longwall mine throughout the various Marcellus shale plays and Utica shale plays that are present here today. So, but before we talk about that, when you're establishing your own longwall plan, you got to think about what you're going to do, where are your reserves, and how are you going to mine this out. So before you even start, you need to look at your full life of mine plan for each longwall and where your reserves are at. And you're going to see throughout this presentation why that's important. You want to establish with as much detail as reasonably possible where those longwalls are going to be, how wide they're going to be, what areas are you not going to mine, where are you going to pillar, etc. Because that's all going to lay the framework of your negotiations with the gas operator and where those gas wells are going to eventually end up in your mine plan. What you don't want to do is you never want to be in a situation where you're committing yourself to unreasonable expectations or mine projections that you're not able to establish once you get to some governing body such as the DEP or in front of a court, and you can't sit up there and say, well, we can realistically mine this, because you don't want to look like you were just trying to come up with a plan that was going to eventually thwart the gas operator's plans to drill a well. So once you go to submit your longwall coal mining permit, first thing you need to do is identify where all the existing or permitted registered oil and gas wells are within your mine plan. If there are any abandoned or non-registered wells in Pennsylvania, you have the, as the coal operator, have the absolute right to go onto that surface and plug those abandoned oil and gas wells so that you can continue to mine through. There's a couple cases there that our firm actually argued both of those back in the late 80s and early 90s. I obviously was not part of those decisions, but both in Greene and in Washington County, we successfully litigated our client's right. In both cases, it was Consolidation Coal Company to go onto those services, plug those abandoned wells, and continue to mine through. The permitted and registered wells in Pennsylvania, unfortunately, there's no established right to go onto the surface and plug those wells that are currently actively producing. Contrast that with an Ohio case that we'll talk about later, in which the Monroe County Common Pleas Court in Ohio ruled that they could go onto the surface and plug that that active well that was currently producing. I said you were going to have to identify all of the active and permitted registered mines or the wells in your mine area. This is not an extension of Lake Erie or a river or flood zone. These are all the permitted and registered conventional wells that are currently existing, that are currently out there in Pennsylvania. When you throw on the current unconventional wells that are out there, you can see it gets even more. So once you filed your permit with the DEP, there's a 30-day comment or objection period after the last publication in the newspaper. These next three bullet points you'll see, we'll contrast those with the response time period and the different matters when it comes to gas permits. You can see that the well permit or well owner has the right to file a response with the DEP anytime during the 30-day notice period. Again, we'll contrast that with what your obligations are as a co-operator whenever we get a little later. And you can see there in that last slide, the owner or operator of an oil and gas well has the right, they can request an informal conference with the DEP to discuss your mine plan and how it's going to impact their current well that might be situated in your mine plan. So now you have your mine plan, you've given notice to the current well owners, and you're mining along, and then you get a receipt from an oil and gas operator that they want to put a well in front of your long well or in your mine plan. And it could be in any one of these different areas. It could be in an abandoned area of an active mine. It could be in an abandoned mine that's not connected to an active mine. It could be in your mining reserves way out into the future, but would still have an economic impact on your future coal mining. Or it could be within your mining reserves in your specific mine plan that you filed with the DEP. Could be in a longwall gate abutment. Or in, if you're lucky, they've come to you with it being in a barrier of some site of some type, either an interior barrier or a perimeter barrier. So when you get that notice of the well permit application, the first thing you need to do is determine, well, do we want to object to it? Is this somewhere that is going to impact our mining, and do we want to see if we can't move it to a different location? It may be that they, if you're lucky, that they've looked at your mine plan that you have on file with the DEP, and they've figured out where they're going to put it, and it's in an area that is not going to impact your coal mining, so you can not make any objections to it. But if you do decide that you're going to object to it, there's three different statutes that you can fall under. The first is the Oil and Gas Development Law of 2012. That's commonly referred to as Act 13. The second is the Coal and Resource Coordination Act, also Act 214, and the Oil and Gas Conservation Law. You can see that both of those second two have, if applicable, after them. They are pretty narrow in scope, and we'll address each of those here in a couple of slides. So once you get the notice of the application and you've decided that, yes, we're going to object to the location and we're going to fall under one of those statutes, you have 15 days from the date that you got that you received that notice to file your written objections with the DEP. Contrast that with the 30 days after the last publication period that the owner of a permitted well had to respond to your permit it's a little bit more cumbersome or more cumbersome on the coal operator to receive that, figure out where it is in their mine plan, get together with their council, the engineers and the operators, decide if it's going to make an impact, and then get your written objection into the DEP on time. It's a pretty tight time frame. But once you decide that you are going to object, you have to file your written request for a conference under Section 3212B or 3251 within the 15-day period. Now, there's two different standards there, 3212, 3251. Those dictate who can actually object to the permit, and we'll go through each of those in a slide here as well. But before we go to that, I wanted to just show a couple of definitions. If you recall back to the previous slide, Act 13 is pretty broad. There's no applicability restraints on that. You can see a well definition is all wells except for potable water, degas, and landfill wells. An operating coal mine is a mine that has produced within the past 12 months, is currently producing, or that may produce in the future. And outside coal boundaries is your coal acreage assigned to an operating coal mine under the permit issued by the DEP. So under 3212, this tells you exactly who has the right to object to that permit, that well permit that you received. The surface owner under 32A has the right to object. So if you're the surface owner and you get notice that the well is going to be drilled on your surface, you have an opportunity to object as well. And those obligations are set forth in the statute as well. I'm not going to go over those today. But the other entity that can object to the permit is a proposed well with inside existing coal boundaries of an operating coal mine or within 1,000 feet beyond that, or alternatively, a coal mine that is projected and platted but yet not in operation. Under either of those you need to establish that the proposed well will allegedly unduly interfere or endanger the mine. And that unduly interfere or endanger the mine is going to be a theme throughout the remainder of the presentation. You're going to see that those are keywords that you want to establish in front of the DEP, or if eventually you get in front of a court, you're going to want to argue that as well. I also talked about 3251. So under 32, under the prior section, surface owners and coal operators. This is a broad general umbrella that says any person, including the DEP, when they receive that, can request that a conference be held if they have a direct interest in the well location. So the distinguishing between the 3212 and the 3251 was the case Foundation Coal versus the Pennsylvania DEP. In that case, Pennsylvania Commonwealth Court said that a projected and platted coal mine means that it's acreage included in a complete CMAP filed by the coal operator with the DEP. In this particular instance, there was no CMAP that was on record with the PADEP. So therefore, the court ruled that Foundation did not have 3212 legal standing. But regardless, they were allowed to proceed under the general umbrella standing of 3251. So it's pretty important ruling that even though you should have all of your everything projected, platted, everything laid out, even if you don't, the court seems to be willing to allow you to proceed under the general umbrella of the 3251 standing. A couple notes on this case. Like I said, the key to establishing the unduly interference is to have your established panel widths, panel lengths, no mining areas, etc. And the court noted that there were no DEP guidance documents regarding the further meeting of projected and platted, but not yet operated. And as far as I know, they did not; they have not done so since that time, as well. So you've decided that you do have stand. You've received the permit application. You've decided that you're going to object, and you decided that you do have standing either under 3212 or 3251. What you need to do is decide, are there any alternative well locations? Is there any place else that we can put this well that would still allow them to develop their oil and gas interests, but would still allow us to mine our coal in a manner that would be less intrusive to us? And that's where the engineers and the operators come into place and can advise on that. So once you serve your objections on the DEP must hold a conference between the coal operator and the oil and gas operator within 10 days of the receipt of the objections. 3251 actually gives the DEP 90 days, unless notarized otherwise in the statute, which it is, for the 10 days under 3212. But usually, if you tell the DEP that you're working with the oil and gas operator and you'd like to not have the conference within 10 days, they're pretty busy, so they'll usually move that back for you as well. If the parties cannot agree, and you do actually have to have the conference, then the sole role of the DEP is determining a location nearest possible to the original area without unduly interfering or endangering the mine. And again, you'll see, you'll want to bring different alternative plans to that conference to establish where you think the well should be. When you include your objections, your initial objection letter to the DEP, the regulations under Act 13 specifically tell you what it is that you need to include. And I've listed them all here, but they're pretty dry. But it's basically all the information that was in the permit here initially, as well as they want you to tell them where the mine would be drilled. Is this a projected, platted, or permitted area that hasn't been operated? Is it in your perimeter area? Is it in a workable coal seam, et cetera? Again, this is just a laundry list of things that you need to include in your objections as well. Copy the plans, maps, or projections of the mining area underlying the proposed well. Whether the owner or operator believes that the well will pose undue interference or endangerment to the mine. They tell you that you have to tell them whether there is a financial impact posed by the well, but it's important to note that the DEP sole purpose in this process is to dictate where the well is going to be drilled. They do not get into financial impacts between the coal operator, how much coal you're going to lose if the well is drilled in a certain location, or vice versa, how much oil and gas profits they're going to lose if they can't drill the well in a certain location. That is governed later, which we'll talk about again in a few slides. Sorry for all the teasers, but and again, your objections need to include an alternate location. The department will not consider any alternate locations that they do not receive by the time that first conference occurs. So if you come up with an alternate location after that, they're not bound to consider that. You might be able to talk them into doing it, but they're not obligated to do so. So that was under Act 13. If you decide that you're going to proceed under Act 14, again, there's some general definitions. You can see that this is a little bit less broad, even from the definitional perspective. An active coal mine includes a workable coal seam extending 5 mining years beyond the currently permitted area. There's definitions for gas and oil wells, as well as the owner, which is generally anyone who has an economic interest in either coal or the gas. These are the exclusions, the restrictions to Act 14. You can see it does not apply to conservation wells, which are defined as wells that penetrate the Onondaga formation. That 3,800 feet is an approximation. I'm sure there might be some geologists out there that would say that might be a little bit different. This second bullet point is the most important when it comes to Act 14. It does not apply to oil wells, injection wells, or storage wells. So it doesn't apply to conservation wells, anything below the that penetrates the Onondaga. It doesn't apply to oil wells. It doesn't apply to injection wells or storage wells. What's left? Well, essentially, you have shallow gas wells. And when I say shallow gas wells, that's a relative term as to what is shallow. The Marcellus sits right on top of the Onondaga. Marcellus well would be considered a shallow well. Anything below the Marcellus that would penetrate the Onondaga would be excluded as a conservation well and would not be subject to Act 14 objections. Act 14, the primary purpose, one of the most important provisions of the Act, is that the proposed gas well cannot be 1,000 feet from any other well. And any other well is, it's kind of a broad definition. It's essentially any gas well, oil well, storage well, injection well. If you get the permit comes in and you see that it's within 1,000 feet of an existing well, then you can object to the DEP on that basis. Act 214 is aptly named as the Resource Coordination Act because it does establish how the oil and gas operator and the coal operator coordinate their efforts with each other. You can see that if you are going to file objection under 214, your time period is actually more stringent than what it was before under Act 213. Under Act 13. So if you are going to make objections to the DEP under Act 214, it actually has to be within 10 days. In this instance, the DEP will notify the operator of the well that they've received the objection. And then the coal owner and the well operator, it's the obligation of the two of them to try to work out an amicable solution as to where the well should be moved, where the location should be. If they cannot reach a solution, then each side will choose an arbitrator. Those arbitrators will select a neutral arbitrator. There will be a three-person panel. There's no requirement that the panel has to meet within a certain time unless either party requests a meeting. So each party will try to negotiate an alternate location for the well. If they can't do so, they're not making any headway. Neither party is willing to give. They'll notify the panel that they need a conference. The panel will establish the conference, and then they can present their positions to the panel. The panel will be charged with choosing a location that will not endanger the safety of the mine workers and will allow for both the maximum recovery of the gas as well as the coal, while considering each side's position. Importantly, the DEP has the power to veto the panel's recommendation. So if this panel, which is not affiliated with the DEP, determines that the mine should be, or that the well should be drilled in a particular location, the DEP can actually overrule that and come up with their own location. The oil and gas conservation well, remember, that applies to any well that is drilled through the Onondaga formation. There's no specific provisions in this statute that establishes the relationship between the oil and gas operator and the coal operator. However, if a well is going to be drilled pursuant to this statute, the oil and gas operator has to follow all the applicable provisions. So if you see that and the co-operator notices that they are not complying with the statute, they would have the right to notify either the Oil and Gas Conservation Commission or the DEP of that violation. So prior to the conference that you're going to have in front of the DEP, if you're proceeding under Act 13, before you get to the conference, you want to start preparing your memorandum of law because you're going to have your position clearly set forth whenever you get to the DEP. So again, you're going to assert your legal standing under both 3212 and 3251. You're going to argue that the proposed well location unduly interferes or endangers the mine. You're going to supply alternative well locations. And this is really important, without waiving any future damages as a result of the well location. Because even though you might move this well to a more viable location, you could still have damages that you don't want to give up once you get to a later period. The main purpose, like I said before, is to control where the well location is going to be and have it least interfere with the mine plan. Again, the DEP does not rule on financial considerations or the impact to the mine location. Again, you do not want to admit, even if you might come up with an alternate mine plan that you think will not impact your mine as well, you do not want to waive those damages, because those would be very important in the future. Also, prior to the conference, the co-operator and the oil and gas operator should be working hand in hand to try to come up with an amicable solution as to where the well should be placed. If you are able to come up with a solution, you should do a settlement agreement, and in that, you want to establish specific drilling criteria. Where the well is going to be, how they're going to drill it, and how it's going to impact your coal seam. You also want to have them survey the location of both the well on the surface, as well as have them do a deviation survey once they get down to the coal seam itself, so that you can adequately project your developmental entries if it's going to be surrounded by that mine, or where it's going to be exactly when it hits your coal seam. You also should address in that agreement future public plugging obligations and financial considerations with the oil and gas operating. For instance, when will mining occur? Who's going to give notice? How far out in advance do you have to give them notice if you're going to require them to plug that well before mining comes through? Who's going to pay for that cost? Is it going to be split between the oil and gas operator and the co-operator? Is it going to be the full obligation of the oil and gas operator or vice versa? Is the gas company going to drill a replacement well on to hold the lease? If they have to plug the well that they're going to drill now, and they want to hold their lease by drilling a replacement well, is that going to be in one of your pillars? How are you going to work with them to do that? What happens if the gas company drills this well, you reach this agreement, they drill the well and they decide it's not producing to as much as they'd like, and they're just going to get rid of it now? Well, earlier you've already talked about who's responsible for the cost of the plugging. You should also address if they decide to unilaterally plug that well before you need it, that cost should be on them, in my opinion. And remember, I told you to not waive any damages as the co-operator when giving them an alternate mine location. Well, if you do an agreement with the oil and gas operator, make sure that they waive their damages for any impact that your mining might have to the well while it's sitting there. It's kind of a double-edged sword, but double standard. But so once you finally get to the DEP conference, if you're not able to work out a solution, you've tried to work out a solution with the oil and gas operator, they're not willing to move the well, you can't live with where it needs to be, so you got to go to the conference with the DEP. In addition to all your maps and of where you feel the well should be, you're going to want to bring two sets of experts. You're going to want to bring a coal expert and also an oil and gas expert. The coal expert will be able to testify as to that the location of the current well will unduly interference or danger the mine and the mine workers. Again, the same keywords we've been repeating over and over. The oil and gas expert you want there to say, we've proposed this alternate mine location. It's viable because of these reasons, and that's why we feel you should move it to this location. So you've put on your best show at the DEP, and the DEP now has to make a determination. So if they grant you standing, under either 3212 or 3251, but they grant the permit application over your objection and put it in an area that you do not want the well to be, your next step should be to petition the Environmental Hearing Board for a supersedious to, one, stop them from drilling the well until the EHB can hear the matter, and hopefully you'd be successful in your appeal to the EHB. If the DEP denies your legal standing, which they're unlikely to do after the foundation case, but if the DEP would deny your legal standing, again, you'd file your appeal to the EHB and, again, ask for a supersedious. Those are both what we call administrative availabilities. But you also have your legal right to proceed as well. So if you're denied standing by the DEP, or if the DEP grants you standing and grants the permit application, you can file and prosecute a court action separate and apart from the DEP. And when you go to do that, you have a couple different choices. Like when we first got the application, we had different choices of what statute we were going to object under. We also, if we go to prosecute a court action, we have different options available to us of where we want to file. If we're going to name the DEP as a party to our lawsuit, in addition to the cooperator, if you remember, the foundation case was Foundation Coal versus the DEP, and it was a Commonwealth court case. Well, they named the DEP as an indispensable party, and they filed their action in the Commonwealth Court, which has original jurisdiction over the DEP. If you decide not to name the DEP as an indispensable party, then you can file your action in the Court of Common Pleas, in which the well is planning to be drilled. In either instance, you're going to want to allege these things. The first thing you're going to want to do is you're going to want to ask the court to give you an injunction that would prevent the drilling of the well until the court can make its determination. Again, these terms you'll see under Chartier's block when we talk about case law a little later. These terms were unnecessary or wanton. The Chartier's block is a case from the late 1800s before the DEP had jurisdiction. So that unduly interference or endangering the mine has kind of taken over for the unnecessary or wanton. But Chartier's block case is still controlling. So when you're in front of the court, you want to talk about that language as well. Again, you need to show the court that there are viable alternative gas well locations, not that just you want to stop this drilling for the sake of for your coal operations without any regard to the oil and gas operators' operations as well. You also want to include a count for a declaratory judgment, which essentially means that if the court grants the drilling of the well, that the oil and gas operator still needs to suspend the operations once it gets there, so that you can mine through once you're there. And that's, again, would be similar to what you'd be seeking with an agreement with the oil and gas operator before you even got to the DEP initially. These last counts, remember I told you you want to make sure that you don't waive your damages at any point in time. That may come back to haunt you. This is where that would do so. If you had priorly waived your damages, you would not be able to request the damages once you got to the court. General trespass, a private nuisance, and also specific performance, which would be well plugging in advance of mining, similar to the declaratory judgment count as well. So before you either go in front of the DEP or the court, the first thing you need to do is review what your property rights are. One of the most common phrases we hear from our clients is, or any time that they want to do anything on the surface is, can we rely on our mining rights? We've got to rely on our mining rights. We've got mining rights on this. We want to get on the surface. The mining rights and your coal severance deed will dictate what your relationship is with either the surface owner, the coal owner, the oil and gas operator, and so forth. So the first thing we do when we get that, when our client sends us that permit is we'll check the coal severance deed. One of the things we're looking for is a conveyance of all the coal. When I say all the coal, I don't necessarily mean every formation, every strata of coal, but I mean all the coal within that particular strata. So for instance, if the Pittsburgh coal was conveyed, you want to make sure that there were no reservations of any part of the Pittsburgh coal. Sometimes you'll see a reservation to protect a existing mansion house or the dwelling on the property. Sometimes there'll be a mining restriction around the barn or there might have been a conveyance to an old school lot or graveyard. So you got to check to make sure that there's no impediments there. You also want to check for a waiver of all damages. Most coal severance deeds will waive any and all damages at the time that the coal is sold off, any and all damages resulting from mining operations. That's important because you don't want anybody coming forward with those rights claiming that there was not a waiver of the surface support and you don't actually have the right to damage the surface through your mining operations. Occasionally, but not very often, you might see a Pittsburgh severance deed that would contain a limit on gas well drilling. That's very rare that you would see that, because typically there is a reservation by whoever sold the coal to drill through the coal seam to reach the oil and gas that is below. Very rarely will there be action. Will we find a waiver of damages caused to the coal? So in that instance, in that particular case, that NSIG case, there was actually a waiver of damages that the coal operator was subject to because the language in the coal severance deed stated that there would be no damages for the drilling of the well on the property. You also want to look to see if the oil and gas or the coal was severed first in time. We refer to that as prior rights, whose rights supersede the other. Normally, it's going to be the coal because the early 1900s, you see most leasings. You don't see a severance or a conveyance or an exception or reservation of the oil and gas until a little later. It's important to note that the contract rights that are set forth in the deeds continue to exist and are only nullified to the extent expressly declared in the statutes. And we'll go over the NSIG case in a little bit to see how that plays out. Again, so we talked about going before the DEP, the EHB, before you do anything else. And that's our recommendation to our clients. The first thing you want to do is try to get in front of the DEP if you can't work out an amicable solution with the gas operator. But that is not necessary. In the case of Allegheny Enterprises versus JW Operating, that co-operator did not pursue administrative remedies under any statute. They went straight into common pleas court and made their objections. We think it's wiser to go in front of the DEP initially because the DEP will dictate where that well location should be. And if you're satisfied with that, that's the end of it. If not, you always have the right to appeal and go to the Commonwealth Court or to the court system anyway. And it will be quicker and less expensive to work out your administrative remedy first. The DEP will also, as I said before, dictate where the well location is. So if you've went to the DEP and you've decided on where the well location is, and now you have to argue about damages to the court, you can limit the scope of what the court has to consider to just the damages, what the impact was to where the well was actually placed eventually. Yeah. Then I just have a couple cases here. I'll go through them very quickly. Chartier's block case, like I said, from 1893. This is kind of the seminal case between an oil and gas operator and a coal operator and how the two shall coexist among the property. The biggest thing to take out of this is that even though they talked about a location of the well, they preserved the damages that the coal operator would receive. This is a Commonwealth Court case that kind of a Common Pleas Court case from 1910 that reinforced Chartier's. The court would not grant the injunction to prohibit the mining, but again, ordered the gas operator to drill the wells in accordance with specific safety standards and allowed for a bond to pay for any and all damages resulting from the drilling. We talked about Allegheny Enterprises earlier. This is just here to illustrate that you don't necessarily have to go through your administrative law proceedings. NSING, the important thing on NSING is that they got all this favorable language, and at the end, PA Mines Corporation lost because the damages in the severance deed, the 1973 severance deed, the damages caused by the well to the coal mine were waived. So that was why I said it's important to look at the severance deed before you get too far into this process. And there's that Kuliak case from Ohio in which the court held that the gas operator had the obligation to plug the well so that the coal operator could mine the well. And that has not been tested in Pennsylvania yet. Many co-operators, I think, are very anxious to do so. And it's questionable whether it would be as successful in Pennsylvania as it was in Ohio, just because the law is a little different. But I would imagine at some point in time, some co-operator is going to try to establish this as well. And then my last slide, I just wanted to say that when you get that notification for the well operation and it's going to be in front of your mine plan, remember it could be worse. You could be dealing with all those wells. And that's kind of why it was the Act 214, which talked about the spacing of 1,000 feet between each well, is important, because this is actually Newport Beach, California, during the oil rush. So that's all I got. And thanks for bearing with me. I know that was a pretty dry material. If you have any questions, I'll be glad to answer them. Thank you. Thanks,
Andy, before you get away, I do have one question. Is the DEP any closer to giving us some guidance on the definition of projected and platted?
I have not seen anything covering that, so I don't, you know, it would be helpful, but
it certainly would. All right.